Hello and welcome to Science on ABC Radio National Summer, the fourth in this series. I'm Corinne Podger. Summer is, of course, a time of extremes in this country, so a perfect moment to take on the extremes of the extraordinary universe that we live in, with the help of wunderkind brainiac, the astrophysicist Brian Gaensler. Brian's passion for the stars kicked off when he was a kid growing up in northern Sydney, spending his evenings peering into a telescope. Since then, he's had a stellar career in Australia and the United States, which, as you know, Radio National has followed with keen interest. This year, Brian published his first book, Extreme Cosmos, a kind of Guinness Book of Records for the known universe. So we are back today to the Melbourne Writers' Festival for a session recorded last year, where your host is Natasha Mitchell.
Let me introduce our special guest here at the festival, Brian Gaensler. His new book is called Extreme Cosmos. We all know you as former Young Australian of the Year. I'm just thinking that we'll still be introducing you with that title when you're 65. It's probably worn off a bit now.
Yeah, it gets harder and harder to convince anyone that I was ever once young.
Yeah. Especially as you've got an 8-year-old son now.
Yeah.
He's nearly the age you were when you won Young Australian of the Year.
Not quite.
Brian has worked at MIT, at Harvard, at the Smithsonian. He returned to Australia. We're very delighted to have him back on our shores, leading the charge for astronomy in Australia and internationally. He's the Australian Laureate Fellow and Professor of Physics at the University of Sydney and director of what's called the ARC Centre of Excellence for All Sky Astrophysics. Let's give him a warm welcome. What's All Sky Astrophysics, by the way?
Well, normally when people look through a telescope, they look at a little, tiny little part of the sky in a lot of detail, and there are certain really important questions about the universe you can't answer that way. So what we're trying to do is a new way of looking at the sky, where you look at the whole sky at once, and you get insanely big data sets that are very complicated to understand, but you can now start to address some of the big unsolved questions.
So it's a bit like how we're approaching the genome now, you know, rather than just piecing it together, we're just going, right, we'll just decode the entire genome in one flash.
It's exactly the same thing with the same challenges but the same benefits, yeah.
Brian, you dedicate this book to a little person called Phineas.
Yes.
He's your son. And your dedication is this, for asking the questions I couldn't answer. I can't imagine you couldn't answer many questions. What questions does he ask you that you can't answer?
Well, if there ever was, as all parents know, karma is when you are driven cross-eyed by your child and realise this is exactly what you did to your parents. So he asks a question, sometimes about the universe or about history or about nature, and I give him an answer and he says, you know, but what do you mean by that, or why, or how did that happen? I answer that question, then he says, but how did that happen? And within about five questions you get to the point where you just say, I don't know. And then he says, what do you mean you don't know? You're a scientist. Scientists know everything. And I think that captures a point that really excited me about science as a kid, is that science is about not knowing things, and that you grow up as a kid thinking your parents know almost everything and your teacher knows anything your parents don't know. But science is all about everyone in the room getting the 100 smartest people on a particular topic in the room, and all of them say, we have no idea. Mm. And the excitement is, you know, who is going to be the one that figures out how to solve it?
And you've managed to solve quite a few interesting conundrums about the cosmos in your time. You've been asking the same sorts of questions that your little boy is now asking for as long as you can remember.
Yes.
This is not the first book on astronomy that you've written. Tell me about that first one.
Well, I should say I thought it was my first astronomy book until a journalist was asking me about the book, and they said, so this is your first published book, and they kept saying, your first published book, and I said, sorry, what do you mean when you say my first published book? And they said, well, I was reading some old speech of yours, and you wrote a school textbook for your primary school when you were in third grade. And I'd forgotten about this until they reminded me that I asked so many questions about astronomy and really just wanted to talk about astronomy. Even though we were supposed to be studying other topics at school, that in frustration, the teacher said, look, Brian, I've got a special homework problem for you. I want you to write a textbook on astronomy. And I was so excited about this, and she recognised that this was going to consume all of my energy, and I went home and I traced and copied and all of the astronomy books I had at home, and eventually, several months later, presented, you know, my book to the school library.
Unbelievable. So, have you gone back to find it?
I haven't.
I think you
should. Better still be there. It better have been borrowed many times.
Years of being checked out. Grade 3, that's impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Those books that we read as children really, they cement themselves onto our consciousness, don't they? I remember those books so closely, and yet all the books I've read since I've forgotten, I think. So there was a key book for you as a child, wasn't there? Tell us about the Album of Astronomy that really set you in train for this career.
So my parents bought me a book when I was about 5 or 6 called The Album of Astronomy. It was one of these Rand McNally series that were very popular at the time. And every other book I had talked about, well, you know, this is, you know, what this dinosaur looked like, and this is how long ago this dinosaur lived, and this is how this volcano exploded. It was all very factual. And this book was different in that it basically said, we don't know about this, and one of the big mysteries is this, and we wish we understood that. And as I said before, the idea that there were things we just didn't know blew me away. Mm. And the idea that I could be the one that might get to solve some of them if I was good enough and if I worked hard enough. So I still actually have this book, and I look through it from time to time. The most amazing thing is that 30-plus years on, almost every big mystery in that book has now been solved and completely understood and is quite mundane. But now there are much, much bigger, much more worrying questions about the universe, like what is the universe actually made of and how will it end and all of that.
So
the idea that only 30 years have passed and we've gone from just a bucket full of mysteries to something which is all now just standard textbook stuff just shows you what the pace of astronomy is and how every morning you come in and you just don't know what's going to happen.
Mm. It's interesting you say that the content of that book is now kind of relatively mundane and passé, because your description of, I think you must have been about 21, it's probably the best 21st birthday present, you discover a star and you sound sort of so blasé and nonchalant about it now, because of course there are millions of stars to be discovered. But what was it like for you in that moment where you had that data and you knew, you were sitting with it alone and you knew what you had?
Yeah, it was pretty exciting. And like, even at that point when I was only 21, I knew that your average astronomer has discovered zillions of stars and that it wasn't really something that you get excited about or list on your resume. But until that point, I'd sort of felt a little bit left out because I hadn't discovered any stars yet. And until I had one, I couldn't really sit at the table for the real astronomers. And so it wasn't like peering through a telescope and seeing a glimpse. I had all this data on tape. We still used tape back in those days. And I had to run this complicated computer program, which my supervisor had written for me. So all I really had to do was sort of just keep hitting enter on each file. And I had to look at the plot and decide whether there was something there or not on the screen. And, you know, I'd done this like, you know, hundreds of times. It was pretty mind-numbing work. And then finally one came up that I had, based on what my supervisor had shown me, I knew it had to be real. And so my supervisor's a very gruff person and, you know,
supervisors always are.
Yeah, pretty blunt. And so, you know, I knew that if I printed it out and took it to him, he'd go, oh, no, sorry, we've already found that one. But my gut told me that this was one that he had noted that he'd already looked at this file and he hadn't found anything there. So I knew that seeing something there, that I had found something. You know, I knew that I had to tell him and that he would send it out by email and eventually it would be published and put in a catalogue. And astronomy is very much about, you don't want to keep the data to yourself. It's really all about sharing it. There's no point knowing something if other people don't appreciate it.
Yeah.
But for about, you know, 5 minutes, I had this guilty pleasure of saying, this is my star and nobody else knows where it is or what it is. And just enjoying that moment before I stepped out of the room and told other people what I'd found.
Did you get to name it after yourself?
It would be named after me if I changed my name to J1024-0719. The International Astronomical Union, which is sort of the gatekeepers of everything in astronomy, have rules. If you find a comet, it gets named after you. If you find an asteroid, you can call it whatever you want, as long as it's not offensive and that name hasn't been taken. But if you find a star, then it normally gets given a catalogue name, which essentially is its longitude and its latitude on the sky. So that way people know where it is. Some astronomers do, despite these rules, give stars names, but it's very much frowned upon and seen as a bit unprofessional.
I can imagine you just sort of have a constellation of stars named after people's dogs and cats and kids.
It would be completely out of control.
Rover, yeah. Roger. Yeah. Why did you decide to tell the vast story of the vast cosmos through a story about its extremes? Because this is what this book is very much about, the hottest, the coldest, the densest, the lightest, the fastest, the slowest, etc.
Well, I always loved like the world, Book of World Records, in Guinness World Records, but you know, once I became an astronomer and I used to look at these world records, I just thought, well, that's not that fast, or that's not that hot, or that's not that heavy. And it sort of frustrated me that people always got so excited about a world record. It's the first time anyone has made something that's this hot or this dense. And I always knew that the Earth is only a tiny part of the universe, and a record that's the best on Earth is not really that impressive when you put it in a cosmic context.
Yeah.
So I felt that there are enough things in the universe that go way beyond what we can do on Earth, that it struck me that, you know, no one has ever actually put this together. Every now and then you see some press release or story saying astronomers find the biggest galaxy ever, but I thought it was time to actually, by actually doing the calculations, to try and put together a comprehensive summary of what the real records of the universe
and
are.
And those extremes really, it's a kind of very violent and explosive universe out there, and yet you also talk about the wonder and particularly the elegance of the universe. Why is it elegant to you?
So regardless of your religious beliefs or your view of whether there's a creator or not, I don't think there's much debate that the things in the universe happen naturally. If you believe in a creator, then most people would argue that a creator has made up certain rules as to how gas behaves and gravity works and then let it go and stars do their thing. So you have these incredibly complicated, beautiful things, you know, pink nebulae and cartwheel or sort of pinwheel galaxies and black holes and globular clusters. All of this has all happened with just a few rules. Like, basically, the only rules you need is that gravity attracts and that electrical charges either attract or repel based on whether they're the same sign or opposite signs. That's pretty much it. You let it go, and instead of just getting a big blob of gas, or the whole universe is collapsing down to a giant blob, you get these incredibly intricate, complicated things. So it's pretty amazing that you can start off with rules that are childishly simple and yet get things which are incredibly complicated.
There's a lot of death in this book.
There is, yes.
A lot of death.
Yes.
Dying stars. A litany of dying stories about dying stars. There is a lot of death in the universe, isn't there? It's a kind of cataclysmic death too that stars can have.
So stars like the Sun are rather puny and uninteresting. The technical name, the professional name for the category of star that the Sun is in is a dwarf. It's a very small, unimpressive star. Much rarer, but much more exciting, are stars that are 10, 50, 100 times heavier than the Sun. These are sort of the James Deans of the universe. They live fast, they die young. They burn their fuel really, really quickly. They live for 1,000th the time that a star like the Sun does. And when they finish all their fuel, they explode and, for a moment, can be brighter than every other star in the universe put together.
I mean, when we talk about the Sun, it's lived, what, for 5 billion years? It's got another 5 billion years to go. What happens when the Sun dies?
It would be a good time to begin looking for somewhere else to live. The Sun will die rather gently, but it will do so by slowly over a period of 1,000 or so years. It will cool down. It will turn colour from yellow to red as it cools down. But it will also, as it does that, swell up and become what's called a red giant. And red giants are very, very large stars, and it will actually envelop the orbits of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and probably Mars. So what will happen on Earth is not only will we see the Sun start to become larger and redder, but as it gets closer to us, the atmosphere will evaporate, the oceans will boil away, and everything that's left will be just melted down to a big, giant iron slag. You would hope this is 5 billion years away, so you would imagine that if we haven't destroyed ourselves by then, we'll more than have enough technology to travel to some other solar system where there are other stars that don't have this particular problem. But the exciting thing is that there are places right now which aren't very hospitable for life. There's a moon of Saturn called Europa, which is covered in ice. But during this period where the Sun swells up, Europa will actually become quite a pleasant place. So if you're interested in buying real estate on Europa, you can talk to me afterwards, and the ice will probably melt. So although life on Earth will be terminated by this point in the Sun's evolution, this might be a new dawn for places like Europa, and maybe life will begin there in this very late stage in the solar system.
I'll go and check the real estate website. Prices are already going up now. There's a beautiful moment in the book, though, where you really relate our own story to the story of exploding stars or supernovas by describing us as all being made from the sort of, the ashes of ancient supernovas.
Yeah, so this is something, I mean, there are a lot of things in astronomy which are theory, a theory that everyone thinks makes a lot of sense, but only a theory. But if you get down to the things which are really incontrovertible facts, that there's no wiggle room around at all, one of them is that every atom in the body of all of you and everyone who's ever lived was once inside a dying star. The universe, when it began in something called the Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago, the only types of atoms that were made in the Big Bang, we think, are hydrogen, helium, lithium, and a bit of beryllium, which are the first four elements of the periodic table. Very simple elements. There's lots of those elements in our body, but there's other things in our bodies too, carbon, oxygen, iron, calcium. So you've got to say, well, if the Big Bang only made those four elements, where did all those other elements come from? They must have been made at some point. And the only place in the universe where you can make new elements, where the pressure and the temperature are intense enough to actually forge new elements, is in the centres of stars. And then when the biggest stars blow up, they very helpfully scatter all of those elements all throughout the universe, so they're not locked up inside the centre of the star. And then billions of years after that, there's some cloud of gas that has all these elements in it that eventually collapses under gravity and became our sun and the Earth. So other than the hydrogen, helium, lithium and beryllium around us, all of the other elements, the gold in your jewellery, the calcium in your bones, the iron in your blood, all of that had to be made inside stars.
What do you think of, sort of a side question really, but what do you think of the proposal that we can go and mine space as we run out of critical minerals here on Earth? There's a push to possibly mine asteroids or, you know, other parts of space. What do you think of that whole enterprise?
At the moment, it's science fiction and that we couldn't do it right now, even if we wanted to. But there are companies, not the sort of company I'd be putting a lot of money into at this point, but there are companies who are looking at this because some of these asteroids are just essentially trillions of tons of iron or other elements. And if you could essentially drag them into an orbit around the Earth and mine them, you'd have more commodities than you'd ever know what to do with. Mm. So I don't see any concern or issue with doing that, but technically it's extremely challenging. So it's going to be, you know, perhaps 30 to 50 years before we're capable of doing that. But I think it's something that people talk about quite seriously. I think the real issues are the legal issues of, does space actually belong to anyone? And if someone flies out to an asteroid and says, we want to dig this up, is that something that the world is happy to have happen?
And what do you think?
I haven't thought about it too much. I don't really have a problem with it. The reality is that we do need all of these elements and minerals to sustain our lifestyles, and there isn't enough on Earth to keep us going forever.
It's a tricky one, though, isn't it? It's a bit like people claiming patents for genes that are essential to all of us. Who's got the right to patent a gene? Who's got the right to stake a real estate claim on an asteroid?
There are so many asteroids out there. I mean, and there are millions and millions of them. Many of them we haven't even catalogued yet. You know, if someone said, I own Jupiter and I'm going to start mining it, I guess I'd have a problem with that. But with asteroids, there's just so many of them that I don't think we'd notice if a few small ones got raped and pillaged and dug up.
It's a musical universe. This is truly one of the most delicious chapters in the book. Because I guess our intuition that space, I'm going purely by 2001, The Space Odyssey here, that space is silent. But it's very much not silent. And you tell a really lovely story about the kind of the history of the sort of celestial orchestra. Where does that begin?
One of the questions which I couldn't answer in the book was, when did sounds in the universe begin? I kept asking expert astronomers and they kept saying, well, we don't really know. Some very, very early point in the universe began making a lot of noise. And so, of course, everyone knows that there isn't any sound in space. And the supposed reason for that is that sound needs air to travel in. The fact that you can hear my voice is because my vocal cords are setting up very small vibrations in air pressure, and that air pressure through a wave is traveling out to your ears. And people say, well, space is a vacuum, so that can't happen. Mm. Space is not a vacuum. It does have gas in it, but the gas is of a very low density, millions of times lower density than the gas in this room. It doesn't mean the sounds are quieter, but it means that the notes are much, much deeper. And so you'd actually, to hear some of the sounds of the universe, need to have an ear that was millions of light years across. Mm. And so the first sound waves in the universe began very, very soon, microscopic fraction of a second after the Big Bang. And in the same way that
I've got to say, what's so delicious is that astronomers have actually managed to kind of go back and measure data from those milliseconds after the Big Bang. That's extraordinary, I think.
Yeah, so we haven't heard the sounds. We can't, like, put a microphone above the atmosphere and hear them. But what we can do is take a photograph of the sounds. So what I mean by that is, suppose if you can't hear, if I am whacking the table and you can't hear, then you can't hear me hitting the table. But if I had a lot of grains of rice on the table, you could see them jumping up and down and jiggling as I did that. And that's essentially what we do. We take a photo of gas that's sloshing up and down due to the sounds. And because we can precisely measure the spacings between the sloshing, we can calculate the wavelength of the sound, and we can actually calculate exactly, quite precisely, what note is being played.
Which is exactly what you've done in this book. You've, in fact, you've also calculated the lowest note in the universe. Shall we have a reading? Let's have a reading on of that scene in the book.
And I'll just put up the on screen the object that I'm talking about. What you're seeing on the screen is an image of a giant gas cloud surrounding a black hole. And it's an image of the hot temperature from that gas. And so the object at the centre is called Abel 426. So I'll just read that part from the book. We can come to the remarkable conclusion that Abel 426, an unfathomably foreign object 250 million light years away, is humming in B flat. But this is a B flat unlike any you're familiar with. The sound waves in Abel 426 have an oscillation rate of once every 9 million years, which is 56 octaves below middle C, or about 6,000 trillion times slower than the lowest note that the human ear can hear. Or to put it another way, you would need to add a further 635 keys to the left end of a piano keyboard in order to be able to play a note this low. And you need a really big piano too. The deep bass note being sung by Abel 426 is nowhere near as loud as a supernova explosion. The X-ray ripples seen in Abel 426 correspond to a variation in pressure of around 10%, which is a sound level of about 170 decibels, akin to holding your ear directly against the speaker during a major rock concert. This is not nearly as loud as a supernova explosion, but a supernova is a single deafening crash. In contrast, Abel 426 has been playing a single sustained note for more than 2 billion years and shows no sign of needing a breath anytime soon. The energy needed every second just to hold this note is staggering, a factor of a trillion trillion times larger than the combined output of every power station on Earth. What is the cosmic powerhouse that provides this energy, and why does it manifest itself as sound? The culprit, as is so often the case with the most energetic events in the cosmos, is a black hole.
Ah, the black hole. It's a lovely idea that we live in a musical universe, but it's a sound that we will never really be able to interpret with our own ears.
Yeah, so you find out that all sorts of objects in the universe make sounds, but none of them are the sorts of... Most of them are not sounds that we could ever hear with our ears. So what it tells you is that things in the universe, the way you make a sound here is you smash something into something else. I go like this, or I clap my hands together, or I play an instrument. And what it tells you is that the universe is full of things smashing into each other. Every time something collides with something else, it essentially sets up sound. And because of gravity, everything is being pulled into everything else, and the universe is just full of collisions and debris and catastrophes.
The music of the universe and things that go bang being interpreted for us there by Brian Gainsler, Professor of Physics at the University of Sydney and Director of the ARC Centre for Excellence for All Sky Astrophysics. And you're listening to Science on ABC Radio National Summer with me, Corinne Podger, and a session from the Melbourne Writers Festival recorded last year. Brian's discussing his first book, Extreme Cosmos, with host Natasha Mitchell. So if we live in a universe full of debris, collisions and catastrophes, should we be worried here on Earth?
Why don't we have more collisions? Or do we have them and they're just inconsequential?
Most of them are inconsequential. There are, you know, if you've seen, hopefully most people in the audience have seen a shooting star. The shooting star is just a little pebble burning up in the Earth's atmosphere. It's essentially a collision between two heavenly bodies, just that one of them is large, the Earth, and one of them is very small. The Earth's mass actually goes up by one tonne every day because of all the tiny bits of space dust that crash into the Earth every single day.
Right.
So it is happening continuously. It's just that most of these collisions are inconsequential. Big objects are rarer, so collisions between big objects happen less frequently.
Do you ever lie awake at night wondering about the asteroid that might do away with us all? I mean, I don't, I have to say.
Well, there's a great episode of The Simpsons where they discover an asteroid heading towards them and someone says, what shall we do? And they say, let's burn down the observatory. So, you know, as if it's the astronomer's fault. So, you know, astronomers are very nervous about the fact that if the end of the world is going to come, it's probably going to come from some asteroid, and it will be astronomers that will have to bear the bad news. So we are very careful when we find asteroids that have an orbit that might intersect the Earth to not immediately say, hey, we think we've got something, because inevitably what happens is you get a little bit more data over the next few years and you refine the calculation and it usually just misses. Mm. But eventually there will be, it's happened before, the dinosaurs felt it and there was it will happen. There is somewhere out there an asteroid with our name on it. It's just a question of when, and critically, how much warning will we have? If you get a year's warning, there's really nothing you can do. You can't move an asteroid that close out of the way. But if we have 50 years of warning, you only need to nudge the asteroid's orbit by a tiny amount, and by the time it gets to us, it will miss.
How would you do that?
You can do it in a few ways.
I'm sort of having this vision of a kind of space tug, you
know? Yeah, well, they're
putting the lasso over
it. Pretty much. Well, you don't even have to do that. There's suggestions that if you have a big enough spaceship just hovering next to it, just sitting there, then the gravity of the spaceship, every object in the universe, you and me, have gravity. It's just very small. Mm. But if you have a spaceship just sitting next to it for long enough, the gravity of the spaceship would slowly move it to the side. So that's sort of a space tug. Other people say, well, we've got all these nuclear weapons. Why don't we use them for something useful and just smash them into the side of the asteroid and move it off? Mm. I guess it becomes an interesting political question, a bit like climate change, where if it's not impending disaster, if it's something that's unfolding over 50 years, is there the political will to actually do anything about it?
Probably not.
Yeah, so if you think a carbon tax is a problem, just wait for the asteroid tax.
Yeah. Oh, no. I dread to think. Astronomers have gone back to 10 trillionths of a second after the Big Bang. They've managed to extract data from that time. And I guess it's one of the great existential questions, isn't it? If we assume that time began with the Big Bang, is there a before?
Oh, I hate it when people ask me that question.
Oh, I can't help it.
Yeah, so the cop-out answer is that I don't know. And if I did know and I explained it, it wouldn't be an answer that would make any sense. But I guess the answer is that our understanding of the universe is that there are three dimensions of space and one of time. So we live in this four-dimensional universe. You can move in three directions of space and you can move in one direction of time. And the only difference between space and time is that in space you can choose which direction you go, but in time we can only go forward. So if there is an answer as to what happened before the universe, it has to invoke another one or more additional dimensions on top of that. If we could think in five dimensions or six dimensions, then perhaps the question of what was before the universe would make perfect sense. It's like looking at a globe of the world and saying, what's the most northerly part of the world? And you say, well, that's the North Pole. And you say, well, what's north of that? It's not an answer that makes sense if you can only move around the surface of the globe. And so the question of what's before the beginning is exactly the same geometrically or mathematically as what's north of north or what's south of south. In the same way, if you had an extra dimension, then maybe you could get around that. But the question just doesn't have an answer within our humble four-dimensional constraints.
But it keeps us entertained and well-fueled with existential angst, I think. You talk about a group of people which you describe as the galactic archaeologists, and they are in a sense using the universe as a sort of clock, aren't they? Let's have a reading on that, because
sure.
That's a lovely idea.
Cosmic
too.
Cosmic clocks. Yeah. Okay. All right, so Sydney is the oldest city in Australia, having been founded with the arrival of British soldiers and convicts in 1788. I was born and bred in Sydney, and often wonder what my hometown might have looked like in those earliest days. However, I am left to use my imagination, because that early Sydney is almost completely gone, swept away by the tides of progress and construction. If you wander through the centre of Sydney, near the iconic harbour, the oldest building you can find, a modest sandstone cottage, dates back only to 1816. If you broaden your search to the suburbs, many kilometres from the city centre, you will eventually find two older buildings dating back to the 1790s. Few other traces of the original Sydney remain. In many respects, attempting to trace the history of the Milky Way is similar to trying to picture the early days of Sydney. We know that the universe is 13.7 billion years old, give or take a few hundred million years or so, and according to current calculations, the Milky Way is not much younger, having begun to take shape more than 13 billion years ago. What our galaxy looked like back then, and how it eventually took on its current appearance, is a major area of current astronomical research. There is even an entire subfield of astronomy called galactic archaeology, aimed at using the galaxy's fossil record to understand its history. One thing we know is that few clues are going to be found close to home. Our best estimate, based on radioactive dating of meteorites, is that our own solar system is a mere 4.6 billion years old. Unimaginable eons of galactic evolution had taken place long before the Earth and Sun were even a twinkle in the cosmos's eye. The challenge, just as for historians studying Sydney, is that so much from those early times has been changed, destroyed, or rebuilt. The Milky Way is a dynamic, violent, energetic place. Stars end their lives, often in spectacular fashion. The interstellar clouds that this produces then reform into new stars, and the process begins again. Meanwhile, the spiral arm pattern that defines the Milky Way sweeps through gas and dust, churning and stirring and heating it. Our Milky Way is a reasonably large galaxy, so while all this other activity is going on, it also ensnares other, smaller galaxies with its gravity, engulfing them, digesting them, and mixing in their stars with its own. All this turbulent activity means that no obvious record remains of the galaxy's early history. We are unlikely to ever find the astronomical equivalent to the Roman Forum, or the ruins of Machu Picchu, which we could then use to reconstruct the past. Our only hope is that of the hundreds of billions of stars in the Milky Way, perhaps there are a few survivors of our galaxy's early days. Like a fragment of china or a rusted spoon in an archaeological dig, these ancient artifacts, our galaxy's oldest stars, could provide crucial clues to previous eras.
Lovely. How is the sky a time machine? How do those galactic archaeologists probe the fossil record, if you like, of the sky?
It comes back to what I was talking about earlier about how we're all made of the elements that were made inside stars. So if you consider successive generations of stars and say, well, how pure were these stars? Were these stars just pure hydrogen, which is the main element that the universe began with, or do they have these impurities? Well, the very first stars are almost completely hydrogen because that was pretty much the only fuel available. But those stars forged new, heavier elements, a bit of carbon and oxygen and iron in them. And so when they died and the next generation of stars were born, those stars now had very small levels of impurity in them. Those stars made more carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, and so on, and then they died, and the next level of stars had even more. So we had this cosmic clock, which we call the iron clock, because iron's the easiest thing to measure. But as each generation of stars is produced, it has a little bit more iron than the level of stars before it. So our Sun, which is many generations down the road from the first generation of stars, has, relatively speaking, quite a lot of iron. So the way you look back and find the very oldest stars is you look for stars that have almost no iron in them. We call them metal-poor stars just because they don't have any metal in them. And people have found stars that have essentially almost no iron at all, which means that they had to have formed almost immediately after the first stars because there were no impurities around.
There's so much going on. Then there's this little beast called the Oh My God particle that landed in Utah, I think, in 1991. What was that?
So there's a population of objects that we don't understand in the universe called cosmic rays. And they're actually not rays at all, they're actually particles, little just protons, parts of atoms, that zip through the universe like bullets. These things travel essentially at the speed of light. The difference between the speeds of these particles and the speed of light, you need 20 decimal places to measure the difference. They're essentially a proton traveling at the speed of light. They're sort of cosmic bullets. We don't really understand what fires them. And normally, people find these all the time. If I had a Geiger counter right now and measured radioactivity in this room, there'd be some low level of radioactivity, and a lot of that would come from cosmic rays that are just going straight through this building and into this room.
To some extent, we're protected, aren't we, by our atmosphere?
The nastiest ones we're shielded from, but if we ever go to, say, Mars, a big concern will be the damage that cosmic rays would do to the astronauts inside it and how you would shield them from it. Mm. One of the reasons why airline pilots and flight attendants have a slightly higher rate of cancer than people who spend most of their time on the ground is because of the damage from cosmic rays at the top of the atmosphere. In any case, we find these cosmic rays all the time, and they're normally just in big catalogues. They don't have individual names or numbers. But there was one in 1991 that has a name. It's called the Oh My God particle. Because this thing was...
It had an impact, didn't it?
It did. It basically created this spectacular shower of sparks. It smashed into the atmosphere and destroyed itself and created this huge, bright sort of firework of sparks that astronomers detected. And this particle, so it was only a proton, and it had about 50 joules of energy. So it had about the same energy as a Roger Federer tennis serve, all packed into one proton. And so then you ask the question, well, how does any naturally occurring process take one proton and give it 50 joules of energy? We have no idea. The Large Hadron Collider, this incredible particle accelerator in underground in Switzerland that supposedly, you know, when it gets the full power, will create black holes that will destroy the Earth. Well, the highest energy protons that it can create are well over a million times less energetic than the Oh My God particle. So if you're worried about the Large Hadron Collider destroying the Earth, then you better be worried about particles that are crashing into the top of the atmosphere every second.
Talking about incredible amounts of energy in the universe, it was you, in fact, that led the team internationally that captured the data from what was the sort of most energetic blast of radiation from a celestial body in the world. Tell us that story and what that has produced.
So picture the scene, 27th of December 2004, between Christmas and New Year. I wasn't working, I was sitting in my pyjamas watching football. Actually, don't picture the scene, but there are a lot of satellites, both astronomical and other, up there in orbit around the Earth. And pretty much every satellite orbiting the Earth went offline at exactly the same time on the 27th of December 2004.
Wow, they all went offline.
They all went off. And so obviously something had happened. It was quickly worked out that this wasn't any, you know, some sort of sneak attack by somebody or anything, but it was actually a star 50,000 light years away that had 50,000 years ago had emitted this incredible pulse of gamma rays. And so for the last 50,000 years throughout all of human history, these gamma rays have been travelling at the speed of light across the Milky Way. And on the 27th of December 2004, slammed the Earth, and the radiation knocked out every satellite, disrupted satellite and submarine communications. It actually altered the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. All the ham radio operators who were chatting away that day, all of a sudden, all the communications were cut off. You know, the sun gives off solar flares. This was like a super-duper solar flare, a hyper-flare. It gave off an incredible flare that walloped the Earth. Mm. For the astronauts
for
on the internet... It lasted about half a second. In that half a second, it gave off more energy than the sun gives off in about 200,000 years. Or to put it another way, for half a second, this object was brighter than every star in the Milky Way put together, 400 billion stars, by a factor of 1,000.
Unbelievable.
For half a second. And I just was lucky enough to be in the box seat because the star was at a location where you could only see it with radio telescopes, and all of the gamma ray people didn't know what to do. They said, who knows about radio telescopes? They said, Brian will know. And so I got an email from a colleague saying, urgent.
In your gym jams, they're watching
footage.
Yeah,
pretty much. So I get an email called urgent. Normally, I don't know about you, but when you get an email called urgent, you normally just hit delete, click spam. But this was from someone I knew, and I read it. And she said, I think this star has given off a very big flare. I should say, at the time, we didn't know it was this incredible brightness. All we knew was our satellites had gone offline. So we didn't know it was 1,000 times brighter than the Milky Way. So I wasn't that excited about it. But I thought, okay, I had the home numbers, a lot of my colleagues, and called them at home and got their partners very cross and asked them to go in and unmothball the telescope, and we started pointing the telescope. Mm. And it actually took till the 3rd of January before we could get all the telescopes going again because of the New Year shutdown. All the engineers had taken the week off. And I remember sitting there at my desk, and the telescope's about to move on to the object, and I'm thinking, you know, this better be good. And I thought, oh, great, I've typed in the wrong coordinates because it's like looking at, you know, the brightest galaxy in the sky or something. And then I realised that this was the object, and that this object was ridiculously bright, like thousands of times brighter than it should have been. And what's more, it was fading as we watched. So that was when we first realised that we were onto something that was what turned out to be the brightest explosion that had ever been seen in the history of humanity. And as we watched over the next few weeks, it just faded away. But it started off so brightly that even if you come back now, 7 years later, you can still see it fading away. And what's more, you can now
see it. It's a slow, lingering death.
Yeah, and you can actually see the debris moving outwards. But the incredible thing, it's not a death. We actually thought there'd be nothing left of the star after this explosion. But once the dust had cleared, the star is still there. And it, you know, astronomically speaking, doesn't seem to have a scratch on it. It's like one of those cartoons from like Superman where all the baddies are firing at him and then it clears and he's just sort of standing there like this. The star is completely undamaged. And so we don't understand how a star, and this is quite a small star, it's only 25 kilometres across, so it's like smaller than Melbourne, gave off a flare that was brighter than the entire Milky Way times a factor of 1,000 and doesn't seem to have noticed.
See, it's at that point I would want to go and check out what was going on, and yet you write at one point, you're not really that interested in going into space.
Well, so firstly, I would not want to go anywhere near that star because the sad thing is I worked out that any planets or life within 10 light years of that star is not there anymore. Like, the whole volume of space around it's been completely sterilised. So for us, it's cool. I got a nice paper and a citation and, you know, invitations to speak at conferences. But for people living near that, that would have been the end. Without warning, this would have been this flash in the sky and all life would have gone. Mm. But, yeah, I'm actually not interested in going into space, firstly because I get car sick. So you can imagine how bad it would be in a rocket. I used to be really excited about the idea of space flight and one day we'd go to Mars. But my thinking really got turned around by the Columbia disaster, because those people were the best of the best. They were the sorts of people that, you know, you would hope you could one day be, and they're gone. And to do what? Just to fly around the Earth a few times. So I sort of come to the conclusion that space travel isn't worth the risk. Even if you work really hard at it, it's incredibly dangerous. But for one-tenth the price, we can send a rover to Mars or a space probe that drops into the atmosphere of Saturn. Humans couldn't do that anyway. We can't drop ourselves in the atmosphere of Saturn and check it out. So you can actually spend less money and learn more by just building very clever robots and rovers and machines to explore the solar system for you. I think the idea of having to stick a flag on Mars and saying it's ours now is this very sort of colonial, outdated attitude. It's not about owning things or bringing them back, but just about understanding them. And the next generation of Mars rovers aren't going to just have still photos. They're going to have HD TV in real time and, you know, kids perhaps voting on the internet as to whether the rover should turn left or turn right. So I think that, you know, the exploration of the solar system is just beginning, and it's going to be a very exciting time.
Brian Gainsler, Professor of Physics at the University of Sydney. You're with ABC Radio National. I'm Corinne Podger with Science on Radio National Summer. This week, an event recorded at the 2011 Melbourne Writers' Festival, where Brian's in conversation about his book, Extreme Cosmos, with your host, Natasha Mitchell.
There's a deeply humbling moment near the end of the book where you write, "We live on a small planet orbiting an ordinary star, hidden in the quiet suburbia of the Milky Way, itself a typical galaxy located in an unremarkable part of the universe." Puts us in our place, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it's really been an incredible evolution of cosmology and philosophy of religion, that we used to think that the Earth was the centre of the universe and everything went around the Earth. And then we said, okay, well, Copernicus was right, the Earth isn't the centre of the universe, the Sun is, and everything goes around the Sun. And then we discovered that we live in a galaxy. And even as short a time ago as, say, 1930, we believed that there was only one galaxy in the universe and that the Sun actually sat right in the centre of it. And then we realised that the Sun was actually at the edge of our galaxy. And then we realised that our galaxy was just one of many millions of galaxies. And then we've really even realised that our neighbourhood of the universe is not that interesting. And the worst part of all is that we don't even live at a special time in the universe. So the universe is 13.7 billion years old. And it turns out that about 10 billion years ago, that was sort of the Saturday night period of the universe. There were stars being born all the time. The sky was alive with lights. And ever since then, the universe has basically been dying. There are less and less stars formed every year. The rate at which stars are formed now is about one-tenth of what it was 10 billion years ago, and that rate is just dropping like a stone. So we've arrived in the backwaters of the universe at a not particularly exciting time in the universe's history.
We're always nostalgic about the past, though.
Yeah. Well, that's all astronomers do. We look back at the past and think how good it was. So it's very humbling that, on the one hand, we are a very important part of the universe, but it's also very humbling that, well, it's not humbling, it's amazing. You know, our brains weren't designed to understand the universe. They were designed to find food and to reproduce. And yet, despite that, with brains that weren't designed to do this and without going anywhere, we actually have figured all this out. I mean, we haven't got all the answers, but how preposterous, how outrageous and audacious that essentially glorified apes have figured out that the universe is 13.7 billion years old. I mean, if there is other life out there, I'd like to think that most of them haven't figured out as much as we have. Who knows?
On that note, let's come to some questions for the last little bit of the session. Who's got a question?
I was just wondering, you said that space is not a vacuum, and I was wondering what the composition of that low-density space is and the proportions.
So it's mainly hydrogen, with bits and pieces of all the other elements. You can find every element in space, even up to uranium, but it's 80%, 70 to 80% hydrogen gas, and it's very low density. The typical density of gas in the Milky Way is about one atom per cc. So in something this big between my two fingers, one atom, where the number of atoms in this room between my two fingers is trillions and trillions and trillions. So it's very low density. It's actually closer to a vacuum than any vacuum we can create on Earth, but there is still gas that we can measure and study.
You mentioned that astronomers are very interested in studying the past. There's 20 or so fundamental constants of the universe, and if they were even a little bit different in the past, things would have evolved very differently. Is there much research going on about whether or not these things are functions of time, and if so, what would be the trajectory of the universe if they were different? So going backwards on there.
Yeah, yeah. So you're quite right. You know, there are a lot of constants in the universe that don't have any reason for being what they are. The speed of light, the value of pi, the mass of an atom are set to a particular value. If you fiddle with that number, even by a tiny bit, there's some crucial reactions or events that would never have happened, and the universe would be quite different. On the other hand, people ask the question, well, was pi always equal to the number it is now, or have things somehow changed? So there are people doing that. In fact, most of the lead work is being done here in Australia. There's an astronomer here in Melbourne, Michael Murphy, who has done a lot of the important work on this. And it's a very controversial topic. Michael and his colleagues have found some hints that some fundamental constants were different in the past than they were now. But no one thinks that they've made mistakes, no one thinks that they're crazy, but the level of significance of these measurements are right at the level where some people say I believe it and some don't. So as always in science, progress is made by when other people can reproduce your results. And so we're at a point now where other people are trying to see if they can get the same results in different ways. And as soon as two or three different groups say we see the same thing, something suddenly transforms from speculation to accepted fact, and then we have to start worrying about what this means and how things will change in the future.
Two questions. One is, what developments in astronomy right now are you most excited by? And two, do you have any good astronomy jokes?
Well, the more tasteful end of the spectrum. No, okay.
Well, I guess my favourite astronomy joke reflects the limitations of our calculations, and that there's a very rich businessman who offered $1 billion to a scientist who could work out how to guarantee a prediction for the result of any horse race. A mathematician worked on it for a year and just said, I made some progress, but ultimately there's too many variables, too many unknowns, I can't do it. And a chemist looked at it, the issues of, you know, could you measure the horse's blood flow and respiration, all that, and eventually concluded there were just too many unknowns. The astronomer thought about it for 10 minutes and said, I've completely worked it out. I can predict the results of any horse race you want. The only catch is that the horse has to be spherical and it has to move in a vacuum at the speed of light. To answer your question about what excites me in astronomy, well, my own research, which excites me, is the fact that the universe is magnetic. And magnetism has always been the poor cousin of astronomy. Astronomers don't like to talk about magnetism. But that's changing because we're actually starting to understand it. And if I can tell another astronomy joke, so magnetism to astronomers is like sex to psychoanalysts. No one used to want to talk about it, but now we think it can explain everything. So I like to think that I and my team are at the sort of the forefront of revealing what the universe's magnetism looks like. So we're hoping to be able to make maps of what the magnets of the Milky Way and other galaxies look like. And then to actually answer the $64,000 question, which is, well, why is the universe magnetic and where did it actually come from? Because if I pull a magnet out of my pocket and say, well, how did I make this magnetic? The answer is that I started with a lump of iron and I rubbed it against another magnet until it became magnetic. But then the obvious question is, well, what about that magnet? Well, I rubbed that against another lump of iron. You can't keep going back forever. Something must have made the first magnet. You sort of run into trouble at that point because if you actually do calculations, it's very hard to explain where magnetism actually came from. So one of the things that I'm working on is, what do the magnets of the universe look like and how did people make them in the first place?
Another question. I think we had one here. Thank you.
I've been hearing a lot about black energy, black matter.
Dark energy and dark matter.
Dark matter.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned that in your talk today.
It's a minor detail we don't like to talk about is that we actually don't know what 95% of the universe is. So all the things that most astronomers like to talk about, gas, stars, galaxies, clusters, all of that is made of atoms, the same things as you and me. And the technical term for all of that is what's called baryonic matter. And all of baryonic matter, if you add it up, is about 5% of the universe. Of the other 95%, two-thirds is something called dark energy, and one-third is something called dark matter, and we do not have a clue what either of those things are. So if you want to win a Nobel Prize, the best way is to basically figure out what dark energy is or dark matter. And if you want to win two Nobel Prizes, then please solve them both. Despite the similarity in their names, we're not sure if they have anything to do with each other. Dark matter is some sort of substance that has gravity, but which doesn't emit light. And so when you look up at the night sky, about, you know, a tiny fraction of the things that are actually out there are things that are emitting light. And the rest of it is some sort of substance that just doesn't emit light. The current feeling about that is it's some sort of weird subatomic particle and that there's dark matter everywhere, that this whole room is filled with dark matter right now. But it just goes right through you. It just doesn't interact with normal matter at all.
Wow.
And dark energy is even more mysterious. It's some sort of anti-gravity energy force that is actually pushing the universe apart. So when I was a kid reading my astronomy books, we knew that the universe was expanding, but the presumption was that the universe is gradually slowing down its expansion because of gravity tugging everything back in, and it perhaps would eventually come to a halt and might even start collapsing in on itself again. But we now know that's probably not going to happen. that dark energy is actually pushing the universe apart. And we now routinely talk about the accelerating universe, the idea that the universe isn't just expanding, but expanding faster and faster and faster. And in the old days, people would thought the universe might end in something they called the Big Crunch, where everything collapses back in on itself. But now instead, people talk about the Big Rip, the idea that the universe will eventually expand so fast that the fabric of space-time itself will tear apart. I don't know what that means. It sounds really good, though. but the universe does appear to be accelerating really, really rapidly.
It reminds me of the, you know, the genetics. It's only now that we're saying, oh, right, so 95% of DNA doesn't actually code for proteins. And we used to call it junk DNA. And yet here it is probably having a very powerful function in biology. So same with dark matter, maybe. Let's have one final question, I think.
Yeah, I just wonder if you could comment a little bit on a mystery that has always sort of been on my mind. The relationship between mathematics, which is such an abstract thing that mathematicians can scribble their equations in the solitary of their studies, with astronomy, which is something so tangible and very much out there and measurable in the universe, and how these two very different things seem to link.
Well, I actually don't find them that different. I like to think that God is probably a mathematician, and that ultimately you can learn a lot just by looking at a pretty picture and saying, well, that spiral arm goes this way, and then it sort of curves around, and maybe it touches that star. But to take it beyond just sort of describing things and speculating, you really need the mathematics to add some flesh to the bones. So I certainly wouldn't consider myself a black belt mathematician by any sense, but you know, almost every measurement I do or conclusion I come to does involve getting out my pad and paper and doing calculations. The mathematics is a great way of actually understanding what's going on, especially when the conditions are so unfathomable to us. And so one of the messages I actually want people to take away from the book is that these numbers are impossible to understand. A trillion, a billion, it's very hard to understand for anybody, and a scientist or otherwise, what these numbers actually mean. But the power of the mathematics is that it can take that number and actually allow you to understand what effect it has on other objects or what's going to happen next. If I throw a rock, it's mathematics that tells me exactly where that rock will land and how much it will hurt when it hits somebody. So I think the mathematics is actually not separate, but it walks hand in hand. The flip side to that is one of the special things about astronomy is that you can enjoy it without having to have the mathematics. Anyone can walk out into their backyard with a pair of binoculars and see amazing things. And that's very different from other high-tech sciences. If you're interested in neuroscience, it's very hard to engage in neuroscience unless you're a neuroscientist. You can't sort of do it in your backyard on the weekends. But astronomy is special in that everyone can do it. And in fact, we get a lot of benefit from amateur astronomers, or the more politically correct term is now citizen scientists. citizen scientists discover supernova explosions, notice that stars have suddenly changed in brightness, or help us when we need stars that need to be observed 24 hours a day and we can't risk some special moment we've been waiting years for a cloud to move in front of our telescope. We get keen amateurs from all around the world to observe stars for us. So I think astronomy is unique in that there's an important partnership between the enthusiastic general public and the scientists who are actually doing all the calculations.
And with that, let's thank the enthusiastic general public for coming and being with Brian Gaensler. Thank you.
And thanks to Natasha Mitchell, who hosted that event at last year's Melbourne Writers' Festival. Her guest was Brian Gaensler, Professor of Physics at the University of Sydney and Director of the ARC Centre for Excellence for All Sky Astrophysics, or CASTRO. For more information and the audio of today's program, visit our website at abc.net.au/radionational and go to Big Ideas in the program list. Thanks to sound engineer Miyuki Okiranta. I'm Corinne Podger. Next week in Science on Radio National Summer, from the extremes of the universe to the extremes of human life, just how far can science extend our lifespan? Tune in to find out, and have a great week. Bye for now.